As I mentioned previously, this session after lunch is going to be focusing on the preliminary practices, the so-called foundation for Mahamudra practice. That's, of course, the section of the text that we're about to look at. And we will begin each of these sessions after lunch with a meditation related to one of the foundation practices. And in the second half of the session, then we'll slowly work through the various foundation practices that I mentioned here in the text. And one of the essential foundation practices that we need to cultivate, not just in Mahamudra, but in any system of practice that we follow, is to cultivate loving kindness for ourselves and others. And often in the texts that explain this practice, they tend to sort of explain to folk to cultivate this loving kindness in sort of stages. First, cultivate it to people close to you because most easy. Then slowly expand that out to people you don't know very well. And then eventually slowly expanding it out to people who you find very difficult. And eventually towards everyone. But I think here, particularly in our modern society, we need to add one more step in that process, and that is, right at the beginning, is to really cultivate loving kindness for ourselves. Because often in our modern society, not only don't we have really loving kindness for ourselves, often we sort of look upon ourselves in a very negative way. We often suffering from a lot of low self-esteem, maybe even self-hatred and so forth, because there's this obsessive focus on the negative in our modern society. So often then explicitly we don't have loving kindness for ourselves because of low self-esteem and self-hatred, but also implicitly we often don't really have loving kindness for ourselves. Because remember, loving kindness is the wish for ourselves and others to be happy. Of course, most of us wish to be happy, but unfortunately, our aspirations for happiness are misdirected. So we often end up aspiring and desiring things that are not conducive to our happiness. And so that, of course, is not really having loving kindness for ourselves. If we are desiring and aspiring for things that are not going to bring us happiness and bring us suffering, then that's not really loving kindness for ourselves. So loving kindness for ourselves, of course, also includes developing healthy aspirations for our own happiness. And this is this idea of aspiring for things that are not conducive to our happiness is something that's very well laid out or mentioned by this great Indian master Shantideva in the 8th century. And he says, "Those seeking to escape from suffering hasten right toward their own misery, and with the very desire for happiness, out of delusion, they destroy their own well-being as if it were the enemy." So what I'd like to start with now is then a short meditation on beginning to cultivate loving kindness for ourselves. So we'll start with that, and then we'll start to look at the preliminaries or foundation practices from the text after that. So find a nice comfortable posture. As an act of loving kindness for yourself, allow your awareness to descend into the body and simply become aware of sensations throughout the body. using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. Bring your awareness to the area of your face, softening and relaxing all the muscles in the face. Mouth and jaw, soft and relaxed. And all the muscles around the eyes, soft and relaxed. In this way, allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed, completely at ease. And relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. Letting go of all thoughts of the past or the future. And simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. So let's now begin to cultivate loving kindness toward ourselves. And then we can expand that out to others. And we can cultivate loving kindness for ourselves by reflecting on 4 points. And the first point is, what are your deepest aspirations in life? What is your heart's desire? What would you like to achieve in this life? So picture your deepest aspirations very clearly. Now, no matter how much mental afflictions we have in our mind, no matter how much anger, craving, jealousy, anxiety, and so forth we have in our mind, these mental afflictions are simply like dirt covering the surface of our mind. And beneath these mental afflictions is the natural purity of our mind. This natural purity of mind is called Buddha nature. Our potential to reach the highest goals imaginable. So imagine this inner purity of your mind as a small, white, radiant sphere of light in the center of your chest at the level of your heart. And then arouse the aspiration, may I realize the well-being that is my heart's desire. May I realize my deepest aspirations. And then imagine with each out-breath, immeasurable rays of light radiating out from the sphere of light at your heart, filling and saturating your entire body and mind. Imagining that your deepest aspirations are being actualized, realized here and now. Now we can reflect on the second point. What would you love to receive from the people around you and the world at large in order for you to fulfill your deepest aspirations? What types of friendship, guidance, and material assistance would you like to have to help you in your deepest aspirations? And then arouse the thought, may I receive all that I need to help me to realize the genuine happiness that I seek. And then with each in-breath, imagine reality rising up in the form of white light streaming in from all directions, providing you with everything you need. Now, the help that we receive from the world around us is not enough for us to realize our genuine happiness. For this, inner transformation is essential. So the third point we can reflect on is, how would you love to transform and evolve as a person? What faults would you love to be free of? What qualities would you love to develop and cultivate? And then arouse the aspiration, may I cultivate the true causes of my own fulfillment. And then with each out-breath, imagine immeasurable rays of light radiating out from your heart, filling and saturating your entire body and mind. Imagining that you're actually transforming into the person that you want to be here and now. And then the last point to reflect on is, for the sake of your own fulfillment, and in order to make your life as meaningful as possible, what would you really like to offer to the world? How would you like to benefit the world? How could you use your own unique talents to benefit others? And then with each out-breath, imagine immeasurable rays of light radiating out from your heart in all directions. Imagining that you're actualizing this offering to the world here and now. So let's go back into the text. So remember, the text we are following is a text written by Panchen Losong Chögyi Gyaltsen in the 16th century, 16th, 17th century. And he's writing down the oral instructions that he received from his guru, from his teacher. And these oral instructions have been passed down from master to disciple from Lama Tsongkhapa, the founder of the Gelug school of Tibetan Buddhism. And he put together this Gelug approach to Mahamudra by receiving teachings from great Kagyu masters, whose lineage is Mahamudra, and then supplementing and with that with his own profound method for coming to realize emptiness. And so that's what we're following here in this text. And as we saw earlier, the text is divided into these three sections, the entering into the text, just by paying homage, by praising his Mahamudra and his teacher, making a promise to compose the text. And now we're going into the actual explanation of the text, which has three parts: the preliminaries, the actual practice, and the conclusion. And now we're going to go into the preliminaries. So the preliminaries, of course, are the foundation practices, the practices that are necessary to have a good basis to then go into Mahamudra practice. So let's have a look at what that includes or entails. So we're in the middle of page one of the text. Maybe put some lights on. Yeah, sure, thanks. And so here, the first sentence, it says, in order to have a doorway for entering into the Dharma and a central pillar for the Mahayana, sincerely go for refuge and generate bodhicitta, without these being merely words from your mouth. So there's quite a number of things to explain and talk about there. Firstly, this word Dharma. Dharma, of course, is a Sanskrit word, and actually this word has many meanings. In fact, one text I studied listed at least 10 different meanings for the word Dharma. There are a couple of ways in which this word is mainly used. One way that it's often used is simply to mean phenomena, things that exist. So often in text we hear about, observing all dharmas and so forth, and there we're really just talking about all phenomena. So that's one way that sometimes the word dharma is used. There are two other ways which are quite relevant here that are very common usage for the word dharma. And the second one is the meaning that Dharma is the actual teachings of the Buddha, the scriptures, means the written and verbal teachings of the Buddha is the Dharma. So that's one way that the word Dharma is commonly used, simply to refer to the teachings. And another way, which is also very relevant here, is as what's called path. the path. And the path, of course, is we're talking about how much we've transformed our mind. And what we're talking about here is realization. When we've integrated these teachings into our mind and come to realize them, and they've become part of our mind, that's the path. And so that's often how the word Dharma is described as well. So here the word Dharma in terms of teachings has the idea or the meaning that something which you can rely upon is the teaching. So that's the sort of the meaning of the word Dharma here. And here, in terms of path or realization, the word Dharma sort of implies something which is true and correct. So these, particularly these two, are very relevant here, but also sometimes you'll find this meaning of the word Dharma. So sometimes when in the text it means this, and people are not aware of that, they see the word Dharma and they're thinking one of these, and they're thinking, that doesn't sort of make sense. So just to be aware that sometimes when you see the word Dharma in texts, it just means phenomena in general, just anything that exists. Now, here in the text, it says, in order to have a doorway for entering into the Dharma. So we can talk about this door of entry in a number of ways. So here in the text it says, in order to have a doorway for entering into the Dharma. So we can talk about a door of entry into the Dharma. And so when we talk about it in that way, we're really talking about this. You know, what's the doorway for entering into the Buddhist teachings? What sort of is the measure for us to enter into the Buddhist teachings? And the door of entry here, it mentions, is that you need to sincerely go for refuge. So the door of entry into the Dharma, the door of entry in terms of into the Buddhist teachings, is refuge. So what do we mean here by refuge? As the name suggests, of course, often when we're faced with some difficulty in our life, we turn to something to help us, to protect us from that difficulty. We take refuge in something. Normally, if it's raining, of course, we take refuge under cover somewhere, or maybe an umbrella or something. If we have some physical or mental problems, we often turn to someone or something for refuge, to help us. But unfortunately, of course, often when we have some sort of suffering experience, we turn to something or someone that's not really going to help us much. For example, you know, often when we have some particularly mental suffering and we don't know how to deal with it, we turn to things like drugs and alcohol for refuge, basically just to numb the pain. But of course, it's not really a good source of refuge because it's not really resolving any issues. And they themselves, of course, drugs and alcohol just create a lot of physical problems in the body. So here, when we talk about going for refuge, then in terms of the door of entry into Dharma, we're talking about going for refuge to three things called the three jewels. And the three jewels are Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. And to sort of understand a little bit what we mean by these, we can talk about using an analogy. When we have some sort of physical illness, who or what do we normally turn to for refuge if we have some sort of physical problem, physical illness?
Doctor.
Doctor. And why do we turn to the doctor for refuge? It's because we believe that the doctor is qualified to help us, that they can help to diagnose what our problem is and hopefully give us a cure. And so therefore we turn to the doctor for refuge. Likewise, here, the Buddha is like the doctor, because the Buddha is someone who has overcome all their own suffering, so they're very qualified and they can give us some very good advice and some help to overcome our suffering. So the Buddha is like the doctor. Of course, when we go to the doctor, if we have some physical illness, the thing that's actually going to cure us is not the doctor, but the medicine that they prescribe. So the Dharma is like the medicine. That it's the Buddha himself can't wave a magic wand to cure us of our illness. The way that the Buddha can help, of course, is by the Dharma, the teaching. So here we talked about the Dharma in terms of scripture or teaching. So that's like the medicine. Now, then here the word Dharma can refer to both the second and third meaning that I mentioned. The Dharma in terms of the Dharma in terms of scripture or the teachings, and the Dharma in terms of the path or realizations. So in the analogy, the scripture would be a little bit like the script for the medicine that the doctor prescribes, or even actually the actual medicine. Even if we've got the best medicine in the world in our hand, if we don't swallow it, of course, it's not going to help at all. Likewise here, we could have the best teachings in the world in our hand. We could be listening to the best teachings in the world, but if we don't swallow it, if we don't integrate it, then it's not going to help us. So this is realization. Realization is how much we have internalized these ideas and come to realize them. So the analogy there would be then actually taking the medicine, swallowing the medicine. And then sometimes if we have some illness, we may need to get an operation and then recover in hospital. And then, of course, it's the nurses who help us to recover, to become healthy again. So the Sangha here, this spiritual community, is those people around us who help us to take the medicine, to recover, to become healthy. So the Sangha is the spiritual community around us who support us in the spiritual path. So these are the three jewels. And so in terms of door of entry into the Dharma, refuge here means when we really have the idea that the Buddha, the Buddha's teachings and the spiritual community who are implementing them can really help us in our life, when we make that decision, then we have the door of entry into the teachings, because then we're going to be interested in following the teachings of the Buddha. Now, often this going for refuge to the three jewels is formalized in terms of doing what's called a refuge ceremony. And in the refuge ceremony, we're making like a formal commitment that in my life, I believe these three jewels can really help me, and I want to rely on these three jewels in my life as a source of refuge. So we can make that formal commitment, which can be very useful, because it's a bit like if you're in a relationship with someone and you really want to make a formal commitment to them, then often we do the marriage ceremony. And that can also be helpful, because in terms of if some difficulty were to come up, and we haven't made that formal commitment to that person, then we may think, oh, things are getting too difficult, I'm out of here. Whereas if we made the formal commitment, we're more likely to try and work through the difficulty. Likewise here is that if we do the refuge ceremony, make that formal commitment, then should difficulties arise, we will continue to turn to this for refuge to work through those difficult times. So often it's said then, what it the mark of becoming a Buddhist is when we take this refuge ceremony. But as we're going to talk a little bit later, it says, without these being merely words from your mouth. So here, of course, it's very easy to go along to a refuge ceremony and repeat a few things after the Lama, yes, 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 I do this, blah, 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 and then, okay, now I'm a Buddhist. I mean, that's not really the mark of being a Buddhist, whether we've actually just said a few words and gone to the refuge ceremony. The real mark, of course, is if we have difficulties in our life, who or what are we really turning to? If we're really turning to these things, the Buddha, the teachings, and the spiritual community to help us, then we can said to be have refuge and to be a Buddhist. So this is the door of entry into the Dharma, is refuge to the three jewels. Any questions about that? Okay. Now, so this is the door of entry into the Dharma, into the Buddhist teachings. But then we saw yesterday in that chart, the three vehicles chart, we have the Theravada, Mahayana, and Vajrayana vehicles. How do we enter into those vehicles? Because this is just entry into the Buddhist teachings in general. But how? What marks the entry point into the Theravada, the Mahayana, and the Vajrayana? So these vehicles, of course, are the paths to nirvana and enlightenment. So how do we enter into the Theravada path, the path to nirvana? What's the entry point, the door of entry? Is, of course, when we develop the aspiration for nirvana. That's the door of entry, which is normally translated as renunciation. Again, this is not a very good translation. It really means the aspiration for liberation, the wish for liberation, the aspiration for nirvana. So when we developed this, we enter into the Theravada path. How do we enter into the Mahayana path? Is, of course, when we develop the aspiration for enlightenment. The door of entry into the Mahayana is bodhicitta, which is mentioned here in that it says, for entering into the Dharma and a central pillar for Mahayana, sincerely go for refuge and generate bodhicitta. So bodhicitta is the door of entry into the Mahayana. So again, when we develop this aspiration for enlightenment, so remember, bodhi is Sanskrit for enlightenment, citta is Sanskrit for mind. So the mind of enlightenment is the aspiration for enlightenment. So when we develop this, then we have the door of entry into Mahayana. And then what is the door of entry into Vajrayana or Tantra? The door of entry is empowerment or initiation. We're going to look at this briefly a little bit later in the text this afternoon. So empowerment is where you receive an empowerment, an introduction into the particular tantric practice from your teacher. And that empowers you to do the practice. And that is really the door of entry into the Vajrayana practice. So these are the doors of entry into the various levels here. Dharma in general, Theravada path, Mahayana path, Vajrayana path. Any questions about any of that? So if we look at that sentence again, it says, in order to have a doorway for entering into the Dharma and a central pillar for the Mahayana, sincerely go for refuge and generate bodhicitta without these being merely words from your mouth. So not only here we see that refuge is the door of entry into the Dharma, and that the door of entry into the Mahayana is bodhicitta, but we also see that the central pillar for the Mahayana is bodhicitta, meaning that the whole Mahayana path is supported or sustained on bodhicitta, meaning that to enter into the Mahayana is not simply when we intellectually develop this wish, when we say, okay, I really wish for enlightenment for the benefit of others. It's when this becomes what's called uncontrived, meaning that we reflect on this aspiration, this wish for enlightenment for the benefit of others. We keep reflecting on it until the point where that aspiration is something that naturally and spontaneously comes up in our mind throughout the day. Because then everything we do is based on that motivation. So that's what it means for the central pillar, that everything we do has that motivation of bodhicitta. So it's not like we develop bodhicitta at the beginning, we enter into the path and then we sort of forget about it. It doesn't work like that. So therefore, we need to really work on cultivating this bodhicitta to the point where it's something that's really integrated in our mind. It's something that really is spontaneously and continuously there throughout all of our activities. Now, how do we go about generating or cultivating this bodhicitta? And we're going to look at that a little bit more in the evening sessions. But just a few words here now. So bodhicitta, remember, the mind of enlightenment, is really comprised of two aspirations. Because there's the aspiration for our own enlightenment. And the reason we have that is so that we can help to liberate others from suffering. So also in bodhicitta, there's the aspiration to benefit others, to liberate others from suffering. So bodhicitta has both of these aspirations. The aspiration for enlightenment, the aspiration to benefit others. And bodhicitta, as I said, we want to cultivate it so it becomes uncontrived. It's something that's integrated within ourselves. So often in the text, how to start to do that, we can talk about doing it in at least two stages. And often you'll find in the text what's called aspiring bodhicitta and engaging bodhicitta. And to understand the difference between the two, often the analogy given here is, imagine that you need to go to a certain place. Then to get there, first we have to develop the wish to go there, because if we have no wish to go there, we're not going to go there. And then you actually have to go there. So aspiring bodhicitta is like developing the wish for enlightenment. Engaging bodhicitta is then actually taking steps to move to enlightenment. So within engaging bodhicitta, we're actually moving towards enlightenment. And remember in the Mahayana, in that chart, we saw there the practices are the six perfections. So here we're talking about engaging in these six perfections practices. And we saw there in your chart, the six perfections were generosity, ethics, patience, joyous effort, concentration and wisdom. And what makes those six practices, for example, what makes generosity a perfection of generosity is this, the central pillar of bodhicitta. So there's a big difference between, for example, giving some food to a beggar with a motivation of just wishing to help them versus giving the food to a beggar with a motivation that may this act to benefit them, but also that may this act as a cause for me to achieve enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings. That's what makes it a perfection of generosity, that motivation of bodhicitta. So this is engaging bodhicitta, is doing these practices sustained by the central pillar of bodhicitta. That bodhicitta is the underlying motivation in everything we do. So that's the meaning here of the word central pillar. It supports everything we do in the path. Also sometimes in the text, and then it's time, nearly time for a tea break, also sometimes you see a presentation also that talks about the two types of bodhicitta, but it's not this list. Sometimes you see a presentation that talks about the two types of bodhicitta in terms of conventional bodhicitta and ultimate bodhicitta. I just thought I'd bring this in here because it's often you see that. And if you think that, and if, as soon as you see two types of bodhicitta, if you think this, then maybe some confusion, because in certain cases, they're not talking about those, but they're talking about this division. And here, conventional bodhicitta is this aspiration for enlightenment, the door of entry and the central support for the Mahayana path. So conventional bodhicitta is what we normally think of as bodhicitta. Ultimate bodhicitta is really the mind that is realizing the ultimate, the nature of reality. So ultimate bodhicitta is emptiness. So ultimate bodhicitta is a realization of emptiness. But again, that realization of emptiness is supported by the aspiration of bodhicitta. So that's what makes a realization of emptiness ultimate bodhicitta. If we don't have the motivation of bodhicitta and we realize emptiness, it's not ultimate bodhicitta, but it is a realization of emptiness. When that realization of emptiness is supported by this central pillar, by the motivation of bodhicitta, or conventional bodhicitta here, then we can call that realization of emptiness ultimate bodhicitta. Because it's bodhicitta realizing the ultimate. Any questions about either of those two?
Somehow, I really can't believe you can cultivate a wish. You either have a wish or you don't have it.
But how do you then first have it if you don't have it? Don't you need to cultivate it to get it? Like if you want something that you don't have, don't you need to do something to get it? Yeah.
You
have to develop the wish.
You are developing, but you don't have to develop the wish. You already have it.
You do?
Oh, you do a lot.
You? Yeah, and if you don't, you can generate it. So you can't? So if you don't have the wish from birth, then there's no chance of you ever developing a new wish. You never develop any new wishes in your life?
No.
No?
I mean, unconsciously, like, if I...
You don't?
I either want to eat it or do not want to eat it.
But don't you then sometimes look, maybe on TV, and you see some nice place and you go, oh, I'd like to go there. Isn't that developing the wish to go there?
It's not developing
the
wish. No. I saw a place and okay, I like it, but it's not, I haven't done anything to develop that wish. It just emerges.
Ah, so you didn't look at that place and see how it was so attractive and how you like that sort of things.
Like, for example, if I don't know, it's like making yourself loving a person, which you don't have. Maybe you can do some steps, maybe find some nice features of that person. Like, but again, you just see. By making those steps, you see, maybe this person is worth of I don't know, some sympathy or something like that, and you find like better feelings towards him.
Well, that's developing. Like
that. But it's not developing.
That is. That's what it means to cultivate. That's exactly the meaning of cultivating, is by reflecting on. Like, in that person, in terms of loving kindness, by reflecting on the fact that that person is deserving of loving kindness and so forth, then the aspiration comes. So I think what you're maybe talking about is somehow forcing it artificially, you know, oh, we have to force this aspiration for enlightenment, we have to somehow force it there when I...
I realize it's impossible to force, like...
Yeah, no. So of course that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about in any of these aspirations is to, like, for example, often is to reflect on the benefits of that thing, and then we'll have an aspiration to achieve that because it's going to bring us and others benefit. You know, so same with everything in our life. So that's what it means to cultivate. And then once we have the aspiration, then often when we get an aspiration for something, at the beginning it's not very strong, and we have it a bit, and then it somehow disappears. So part of cultivating means not only to generate that, but then to continue to work on it so it becomes stable, that we have that wish or aspiration consistently. And that's what it means here for this uncontrived bodhicitta, is to keep working on it so that it's very stable, so that it is spontaneously there all the time. So that's what we're talking about when we talk about cultivating. Anything else anyone would like to bring up? Okay. It's time for a tea break now. So just before we go, though, so we've only just started talking about the preliminaries, but what I'd like to do, as I mentioned already, is work on these preliminaries in this session. So what we're going to do in the next session today is not continue there, because we're going to continue there tomorrow after lunch. Each day after lunch, we're going to do a little bit more of these preliminaries, which covers the rest of that page and then halfway down to page 2. So that all that material, we're going to chip away at it a little bit each day at 2 o'clock. So then in the next session, we're going to start in the actual practice, and then go on from there in the other sessions, okay? So let's have a tea break now and come back at 3:30. And again at 3:30, we'll start with a meditation. And I said that this next session and the one following are both, in terms of meditation, are going to be Vipassana-style meditations. So we're going to start the next session with a very simple entry-level Vipassana type of meditation. So that's coming. Let's have a tea break first.